Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Brian Leppard. He is one of the architects of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the World's Religions. A little bit about Professor Leppard. He is a leading expert in the fields of international human rights, comparative, and tax law. He was educated at both Princeton and Yale. At Yale, he was the editor of their Journal of International Law. Professor Leppard has multidisciplinary scholarly and teaching interests in the fields of international human rights law, humanitarian intervention, international legal theory, comparative law, including comparative religious law, ethics, and tax and business law. He is the author of 7 books and numerous articles relating to these diverse subject areas. And Brian Leppard has spoken on the subjects of international law, human rights, and comparative law at conferences and other gatherings around the world. Currently, he teaches law at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and he is active in the Baha'i faith. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Brian Leppard. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Fred. Thank you.
Certainly. Last week, if people didn't catch that program last week, aside from giving an introduction to the history of the Universal Declaration, which we won't get into this week, we hit certain articles that I thought might be of interest to people and give you the opportunity to explain them. And so I wanted to start out this week with Article 18, because I know that is that can be a challenge for someone. Now, the first part says everyone has the right of freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to choose, retain, or change one's religion or belief, and freedom either alone or in a community with others, and in public or private, to manifest one's religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. Number two, on that article, there shall be no compulsion in religion or belief. Well, let's just stop there for a moment and talk about the very challenging issue of conversion versus retaining one's own religion. Some religions, it's interesting because I talk to a lot of people who assume that every religion is a missionary religion, that every religion is out to get new members. And to say our path is the correct path, this path that you're on is not the right path. But that is not true. We know this. Anybody who's involved in interfaith knows that that isn't true. So you have some people who do have conversion campaigns and other people who resist those but don't have conversion campaigns of their own. And the people who, it's interesting because my take is that the people who don't have a missionary directive in their religion, they just look at the other religions and say, why don't you just stop? Don't do that. And those religions say, no, we can't, because this is our religion to go and encourage people to adopt our way of thinking. That has got to be one of the most contentious negotiation points, I'm thinking, correct me if I'm wrong, when putting together this document.
Yes, actually, the drafting committee had many discussions about this very issue. And there was, however, universal agreement on the importance of explicitly affirming the right to teach one's religion to others. And of course, this is a right explicitly recognized in the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in its own Article 18. And that right has been viewed as critical because, as you said, everyone should have the right to at least talk about their faith to others. Now, teach may be a word that does carry the connotation of teach as in the person teaching has a superior, more correct perspective on the truth. So in that sense, it may be misleading, which is also why in our paragraph 3 of Article 18, The Declaration actually refers to a right to share his or her religion or belief with others and to teach it to others. Sharing is more the spirit in which we conceive the right to teach. Absolutely, any form of proselytizing, meaning forcing one's religion on others, would not be permissible according to this declaration, and of course even according to the UN Declaration. But on the other hand, the only way that we can have a society that progresses really spiritually as well as intellectually is to have free discourse about matters of religion, matters of belief, matters of truth, and we very much wanted to support this freedom of discourse and also the right of every individual to have access to learning about other faiths. And the only way to provide that right of access is to provide a right of others to share their faith, to teach it. And unfortunately, we do see many cases around the world where governments are trying to criminalize the teaching of religion. And this is a real violation of the right to share one's religion with others. And so we did want to clearly affirm that right, while of course respecting the right of people to say, I'm not interested. Please let me be. Absolutely. That's why it provides also, as you said in paragraph 2, there shall be no compulsion in religion. But everyone should at least have the right to share one's faith with others, and of course, then the right also to say, I'm not interested.
And
but government should not get involved in criminalizing these activities.
Are there governments who believe, though, that, because this is what I've heard, there are governments who believe that missionary activity is really a subterfuge for imperialism?
Well, of course, and whether that belief is sincere or not, or is simply a justification for clamping down on activities of religious groups for other reasons, is not always clear. But one of the distinctions, too, that this declaration tries to make is between moral standards and legal standards. And it does try to draw that distinction clearly in certain cases. So there is no doubt that morally, individuals should use tact and wisdom and courtesy in their discussions with others about matters of faith. But the fact that they should be discussing in a very kind and friendly way does not justify governments then adopting criminal restrictions on their ability to talk with others about their faith. And so, again, the drafters wanted to very clearly affirm the legal right to teach one's religion to others, to share it with others. But, of course, it also very clearly says that this should be done in a spirit of tolerance, of respect for other faiths and respect for other people of whatever opinion they have, whether it be religious or secular. So, again, the Declaration really tries to address both issues. You know, what are appropriate laws, which may be one standard, but also what is the appropriate attitude with which believers should interact with their with members of other communities or their own community, and that should be one of respect and tolerance and not trying to force their religion on others.
Let's talk about your background for a little bit. You are a practicing Baha'i, and my experience in the interfaith community with Baha'is certainly tells me that this is a project that's tailor-made for not just you, but Baha'is in general. Baha'is have really been at the forefront of various projects that focus on global humanity, global unity, and respect for people's various traditions. Can you help us look at your trajectory, how you got from point A to where you are right now?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Well, I actually was fortunate to be raised as a Baha'i, and my own parents reflect the Baha'i teaching of the unity of religions, which you referred to. So my mom grew up in a Jewish household. Her parents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. My father grew up in a Methodist household here in Nebraska, actually, out in western Nebraska. And they both learned about the Baha'i faith. My father actually first heard about it in Sunday school class in his small town in western Nebraska back in the 1940s. He had a very open-minded Sunday school teacher who invited the students to ask about other religions. And one girl said, "Oh, I've got an aunt in Omaha, Nebraska, who's a member of a funny-sounding religion." And turns out she was a Baha'i, so he heard about it there. He later went to Northwestern University, actually got to attend the dedication of the Baha'i House of Worship in Wilmette, Illinois, which is just outside of Evanston, where Northwestern is located. And then he met my mother. They were both school teachers, and they investigated the Baha'i faith together, became Baha'is just before I was born. So I was raised as a Baha'i. And honestly, of course, as Baha'is, we believe that everyone has the right to investigate truth for himself or herself. It is a matter of choice. And at the age of 15, the age of maturity in the Baha'i faith, I got to decide whether I believed or not. And of course, I did believe, and the teaching that most touched my heart was this teaching of unity among all the world's religions. And I loved that. It meant I could go to church with my Christian friends and know that I too love Jesus, and I could go to synagogue with my Jewish friends and know that I too revered Moses, and even go to mosque. I remember going to the mosque actually later when I grew up near Washington, D.C., in Washington, kind of on a field trip with other Baha'is to learn about Islam. So this really affected, of course, my trajectory. I got to work ultimately as a human rights specialist right out of college at the Baha'i Office at the United Nations in New York. I got to work on religious liberty issues, help share this Baha'i perspective. And then when it came to looking into some legal issues and problems, including does the world have a legal or moral obligation to intervene to protect victims of mass atrocities like genocide, I began to reflect on how can I bring this religious perspective into my legal scholarship. And that led me down a path that looked at what other religions have to say about issues like duties to protect victims of atrocities, right? Like, think about the Good Samaritan story, for example. And that, you know, based on that Baha'i vision of unity of religions, I began looking at what all the religious scriptures had to say about human rights. And this is what led me to then meet Dr. Sharma, because I had written to him and asked him for his advice, especially about my discussion of Hinduism, and he invited me into this project at that point. So that was just after it had gotten off the ground, I think about 1999. And so that's what led me to get involved with this project that he had initiated, and I was very grateful for that. But you're right, I felt that this was the kind of project that absolutely I could support as a Baha'i, because it does seek to bring religions together to focus on their points of agreement on human rights and the fact that they offer a quite distinctive vision of human rights that focuses on the spiritual element of human life as a fundamental part of our dignity, and that also, quite frankly, emphasizes the critical importance of freedom of conscience, which is under attack around the world, and not just, you know, the right of believers to believe, but of course the right of people not to believe. The whole concept of freedom of belief and conscience is one that absolutely needs to be upheld. So, yes, I mean, I think, I, of course, I participated in this project in my professional capacity, and, you know, so in that sense, it is, you know, and the document, as I said, had already been drafted very much already by the time I got involved, and I, of course, made my own contributions. But yes, it's one I felt that in spirit I could absolutely support.
If you're just joining us,
background.
Thank you. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Brian Leppard, and we are talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the World's Religions. Brian, last week you mentioned, we both were talking about Sharia and how the Islamic State has interpreted Sharia as opposed to how you understand Sharia from the Quran. And I know that there has been, for the last few years, movements in various states here in the U.S. to pass laws that would negate any Sharia law that might be passed on a local level. And people say that that's a scare tactic. People say that it is redundant. Is it virtually impossible that Sharia or any other law, let's say some, because I know that there is a movement, I can't think of the name of it, they're triumphalists or there's another word that they use, who try to bring Mosaic law into United States law. Is that a possibility ever the Constitution that we have?
Yes. Well, obviously and fortunately, freedom of religion is protected by the First Amendment to our Constitution. And it is unlawful, therefore, for any state government or the federal government to discriminate against any individual on the basis of his or her religion. And so actually there was, for example, a constitutional amendment adopted in Oklahoma, which would have prohibited any application of Sharia law, and it mentioned Sharia by name, and a federal court did strike that down as unconstitutional because it did discriminate against members of a particular religion, namely Islam. Having said that, clearly there may be a place for religious law in that people freely choose to apply to their own private relations, such as a will, right? A Muslim will write a will in such a way as to comply with Islamic law. I'm a Baha'i, there are Baha'i laws regarding burial, for example, and my will includes those kinds of provisions as a Baha'i. And of course, we would want our legal system to protect the freedom of individuals to observe, to choose to follow their own religious law in those kinds of matters. And that ought to be respected so long as it does not contravene any fundamental public policy. And of course, that can raise important questions. What does contradict a fundamental public policy? And certainly I would argue that we don't want private contracts to be enforced if, for example, they would violate fundamental human rights. And of course, this is an important issue for many women, especially of the Muslim faith, but also of other faiths, where they may enter into a marriage contract or a prenuptial agreement that calls for the application of religious law, but might ultimately put them at a severe disadvantage if they later want to get divorced. Right? For example, in some religious traditions, only the man can ask for a divorce, not the woman. So, I mean, these may well be problematic in terms of violating a public policy of full equality for women and men in regards to both entering into marriage and dissolution of marriage. So I think that there can be legitimate limitations on the application of religious law on those grounds, but the principle, however, that individuals should be allowed to choose to apply their own religious law to personal matters that don't have negative impacts on others, I think, is one that should be respected and is, fortunately, under our Constitution. So, again, people in other countries are not so fortunate. But we do have to be concerned that many of these laws are targeted at a particular group.
And it just occurred to me, the word I was looking for was dominionists. Those are the people who if they had their druthers, would place Mosaic law into American law. And so adulterers and homosexuals and everybody else would be under that form of law, which, of course, fortunately for us, has gotten no traction. So I'm curious, would you support in theory the kind of law that Oklahoma attempted to pass if it was religion neutral? Or would you?
Well, personally, I would not. Personally, I would not, because I believe that first of all, the only way that religious law would even be applied is if it were adopted, chosen by parties to some kind of contract in some way. However, I do believe that there do need to be limitations on the application of religious law because, as we talked about last week as well as today, there are clearly religious laws on the books today that discriminate against women, against non-believers, and that would violate fundamental public policy of respect for human rights, and that should not be upheld. But this is a difficult question, and of course, I don't think we can resolve all aspects of it, but we can start with really two foundational principles that are reflected in the Universal Declaration that we're talking about. One is respect for religious liberty, and that includes the freedom of individuals to choose to have certain aspects of their lives governed by their own religious law, as long as it's a free choice. Now, sometimes it isn't, especially for women, but if it's a free choice, that should be respected. At the same time, there needs to be uncompromising respect for human rights, and we do have to be candid in acknowledging that some current religious laws on the books, which I would argue are not consistent with the foundational teachings of that faith, do contravene human rights and therefore should not be upheld by courts. So again, we can't resolve all of the intricacies of this challenging problem, but it is one that is important, and at least there's now discussion about these problems.
So now that we have a Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the world's religions, what happens next? How do we get this into the consciousness of the people of the various religions?
That's a great question, and that's something that really the drafters have been talking about as well. Because clearly, since the Declaration does not allow for any form of compulsion, matters of faith, including, frankly, publicizing this declaration, it really is a matter of just making efforts wherever we can to share it and to generate discussion about it. So I'm so grateful to you for having taken the initiative to contact me, to speak with me, as we've done the last couple weeks. This is exactly the kind of effort that we are envisioning, that through this free discussion of the declaration, the principles in it, this is how it gets publicized. This is how, and of course, it's not so much that this declaration is important, it's the ideas in it that are important. And engaging people who subscribe to a particular faith or people who don't in a courteous, respectful dialogue aimed at looking at how they can work together to realize the human rights of their fellow brothers and sisters, which is everybody, right? And that's the main teaching and principle that we want to share in this declaration, is that all the religions teach that fundamentally we're members of one human race. We are one human family, and all of the superficial attributes that people focus on and obsess about, like even what religion are you, or what race are you, or what is your nationality, are ultimately meaningless from a spiritual standpoint, or we could say for theistic faiths, in the eyes of God, and that we need to bridge all of those barriers that human beings have set up between themselves over the centuries and build bonds of unity. And that message is more critical today than ever.
Do you use the Declaration at all in any of your courses at the University of Nebraska?
Well, actually, I am glad that you just raised that idea. I had been intending to. I've been reflecting on how to use it, because, frankly, I hadn't actually been teaching last semester when it was adopted, but I am actually going to be bringing it up in my classes, and I think I may well have students read it and consider it. I do teach a course on international human rights. It would be very relevant there because we also talk about intersections between religion and human rights. I teach an upper-level course on comparative law where we go into more detail into the laws of particular faiths, and I think it's very relevant to that course as well. So Yeah, I think that's a great idea. So I will continue to think about how to do that.
Is comparative law something that any really good law school will be teaching?
It should be, although I believe that it is taught less often than it used to be. It is not always prioritized the way that it should be, but I think it is critical for lawyers in today's world who are likely to have clients, for example, who are Muslims, who want to include Islamic law in their wills, for example, or who may have clients who are Hindu or Jewish. They need to understand the laws of these different religions to be effective lawyers. And, of course, many transactions cross borders now. I gave a number of examples in the course that I teach here that is now required of every single one of our first-year law students. I gave examples about businesses here in Nebraska that have dealings with Muslim countries. And, of course, their counterparts want to include Islamic law in those business contracts. And that means that lawyers here in the U.S. need to have some familiarity with Islamic law in order to effectively negotiate those contracts. Islamic banking is a huge field you have to create legal structures that avoid the prohibition on the payment of interest, so-called riba. So it's just it's amazing in how many contexts lawyers have to know something about foreign law and in particular religious law. So that's especially true here in the Midwest, where we have many refugees who we have warmly welcomed, and I hope will continue to warmly welcome, who come from these different religious backgrounds and need legal services that are respectful of their faith.
As the Jews say, from your lips to God's ears. Brian, we are out of time right now. Very quickly, what is the website that people can go to if they would like to read the declaration for themselves?
Yes, that is www.worldsreligions2016.org.
Wonderful, wonderful. Brian, thank you so much for your time today and last week as well.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to WGVU's Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella, and Professor Brian Leppard has been our guest today and last week as well. And we spoke about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the world's religions. Please join us again next week right here on Common Threads.